This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Ray. Today is March 11, 2004. It's approximately 2:25 p.m. Central Standard Time, and we're both in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Special Collections Library interview room. Sir, why don't we begin with a basic biographical sketch of yourself. Could you tell me when and where you were born and a little bit about growing up in your childhood?
Okay. I was born and raised in Dallas, Texas, and went to grade school, junior high school there, and I had two brothers and a sister. We all went to the exact same schools in our turn. In high school, I ran track in high school. I was a half-miler, and also boxing the Golden Gloves. Okay. Enjoyed that kind of thing. I was too small to play football, and I was kind of aggressive, so it looked like a good way to get some of that out of my system. And I was a pretty mediocre student, and not so much because I couldn't do the work, it was because I was more interested in things that sort of taking place outside the classroom. Anyway, I graduated from high school, and because I did run track, I ran track for 1 year at East Texas State University in Commerce, Texas, and I majored in art. Okay. Discovered I really wanted to be an artist, so I decided I better go figure out what I needed to do. In those days, we had to go in the military. This was the year 1957, so I went into the Marine Corps as a young enlisted man.
Okay.
And I had an interesting thing happen to me there. First of all, first time I ever had an IQ test, and they gave it to me, and I discovered I was pretty high up the ladder on it, which very much surprised me. They also gave me an opportunity to go to the Naval Academy. When I say an opportunity, they gave me an opportunity to compete to go to the Naval Academy by sending me to a what they call the prep school at Bainbridge, Maryland, to give me the math, physics, and all the things I didn't take in high school I should have.
Okay.
But when I looked at all that, it just looked like it was a long period of time to, you know, a year at the prep school and 4 years at the Naval Academy and 4 years in active duty, another year and a half I wanted to fly. Gee, I'll be almost 28, 29 years old. Gee, that's ancient. So anyway, I decided not to do that. So I spent my time in the Marine Corps as a young enlisted man, and I was stationed at the Marine Barracks Hawthorne, Nevada, and I was a military policeman. And from there, I went to the 1st Marine Division, Camp Pendleton, California, where I was in the 1st Marine Division, and got out as a sergeant. And by the way, I picked up a nice young lady in Nevada, and 45 years later, still married to her.
Great.
We had a couple of kids and so on. Anyway, I now find myself out of the Marine Corps and need to get an education. So I'll come back to Texas, and I finished my education at what is now called the University of North Texas. It used to be called North Texas State University, and got my degree in accounting. And my original intention was to go ahead and be a CPA and maybe go to law school and things like that. But interestingly, I graduated in June of 65, and in, I think about April of 65, the Marines landed in Vietnam. So here I am, a sergeant in reserves, and I happened to go to the student union building one day, and I noticed a bunch of Marines in there. You know, there was a Marine, fancy uniform, captain, railroad tracks on, and big naval aviators wings on, and lo and behold, I happened to recognize the guy. He was a neighbor on Orb Street in Dallas, Texas, and he was a football player at the University of Oklahoma, not Oklahoma State. And he spots me, and I spotted him, so we got to talking. And once he found out I was an ex-Marine, and well, if you want to call me an ex-Marine, I'm still a sergeant in reserves, voice said, I think I can land this guy. So so basically, that's how I ended up getting prepared to for my big extent in Southeast Asia.
Okay. Let's go back to your childhood. What year were you born?
1937.
What are your memories of World War II and all that? I know you were young, but...
Well, I do remember World War II very, very distinctly. I was... what I remember most about World War II was I remember the airway drills. And even in Dallas, the lights were off, and you could see the searchlights going around. I also remember as a child in the school, we would, you know, get in the... I guess they call them bomb drills or whatever. We'd sit down to the side of the corridors of the school and hunker down and that sort of thing. I also remember asking a question of my mother once. I asked her, you know, could the Japanese or Germans ever get over here? into our country, because I knew the war was taking place elsewhere. And she gave me an answer that wasn't too reassuring. She said, well, yes, they could, but our Army and Navy people are keeping them from doing that. Well, you know, when I was 6 years old, that was kind of a scary thing to hear. Mm-hmm. But I do remember World War II pretty well.
Okay.
Pretty clearly.
Okay. Did you have any family members that served in the military?
The only direct family member that served in the military was my grandfather, great-grandfather. He was with the 3rd Texas Cavalry in the American Civil War.
Wow.
Okay. So, and I didn't know that at the time. I found it later on when I wrote an autobiography for my grandchildren that about this guy.
Yeah, okay.
Only one that I was a direct member that I remember.
Okay. Tell me about your parents. What were your mom and dad like?
Okay. They're interesting. My dad was born and raised in East Texas, and of a very, I would call them very lower level family, subsistence farmer types. And they eventually moved to Dallas because they couldn't make a living and scrabbling around and working in lumber yards and things like that. So they moved to Dallas, and my dad, I think, only went to about the 6th or 7th grade. He's a very energetic young man, mm-hmm. and he went to work as a delivery boy for a blueprint company, mm-hmm. riding a bicycle around delivering prints back and forth. And 10 years later, he was the business manager for this place. Very, you know, industrious kind of guy. He was always educating himself, mm-hmm. and so he eventually owned his own business in Dallas for about 35 years. He's a big customer. Was a Southwestern Bell Telephone. He had all of their prints and so on. My mother was born and raised in Big Sandy, Texas, close to Mineola in East Texas as well. She, when she got out of high school, she went to East Texas State Normal College, the very same school I went to a few years later, right. and became a teacher. She taught in Mineola for about, I guess, 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. She met my dad through other family members, and that's how they came together. Pretty interesting lady she was. She had a car back in the, and you know, making money back in the days when women didn't have jobs like that.
Right.
So, pretty interesting lady.
Okay. Tell me about your brothers and sisters.
My older brother was a little bit different from me. He graduated from high school at 16, went to SMU, became an engineer, and eventually with Texas Power and Light became a manager in that arena, gave Texas utilities eventually.
Mm-hmm.
My younger brother went to SMU also. He was an accountant.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister, she liked horses.
Right.
And she ended up marrying a young man that was going to be a vet student at Texas A&M. And he got his career kind of got changed a little bit because he went into the Marine Corps as an enlisted man. And he and I have some very interesting discussions because here he was, an enlisted man, fighting the same war I was fighting, and I was a lieutenant.
Right.
So we had different perspectives to help us.
Sure, sure.
Very interesting.
Okay. What was it like growing up there in Dallas? What do you remember about your childhood?
Well, Dallas was, I guess the thing I think I remember, I grew up in the Lakewood area of Dallas,
mm-hmm.
And it ranged all the way from people that were very, I would say, the lower spectrum of the economic ladder all the way to H.L. Hunt's children went to school that I went to. So really, that school I went to had a lot of very interesting combination of different kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
What I remember most about it in comparison today is the children that grew up in those areas were very safe in those neighborhoods. We went all over the neighborhood, riding our bicycles back and forth. Anybody ever got in trouble, there would always be an adult there around to help them and those kinds of things. And we didn't have to worry about it. Either ourselves or our parents worry about us. I think I remember that probably more than anything. Very safe incubator for children, mm-hmm. seems to be like.
Mm-hmm. Did you work when you were young, in your youth?
Oh, yes. I did a lot of I threw paper route for years and years. See, today, paper routes are thrown by adults in cars where they put plastic around, throw them out on your front yard,
right.
and continue to march.
Right.
Well, in those days, paper boys did those things, and we really wanted those jobs because you could make $50, $60 a month throwing paper route. Well, that's
right.
a lot of money back in those days.
Right.
And but what you had to do is put those papers on the porch. And the way we did it was we would fold them and pop them against our knee, and we'd say them like a boomerang onto the porch. And if it didn't get there where you wanted to go, you had to go up there and put it where they could get at it. And when it was raining, you know, you had to go put it inside the doors, whatever you had to do. Then you had to go collect your money every month. And that was the hard part.
Uh-huh.
You'd be surprised at how now Noble had a child come back two or three times before they finally paid. Uh-huh. But that was interesting. I learned so much about how life worked with funnel paper run.
I was going to ask you, as an officer in the Marine Corps, how can you relate that to being a responsible paper boy?
Well, yeah, I learned a lot of things as a paper boy that helped me when I became an officer in the Marine Corps. Uh-huh. You know, money, dealing with people, responsibility, getting the job done. Because, you know, in Dallas, it used to rain a lot. Mm-hmm. It used to snow from time to time, but mostly ice. Mm-hmm. Try and throw a paper out on a bicycle when you're scooting around on ice.
Right.
But you had to get those papers there.
Right.
So I really think the paper routes probably did a lot to develop kids' characters.
Okay.
You learn in the real world. And I'll tell you, if you did a bad job, they'd fire you. So us kids didn't want to get fired, right? We liked having that money.
Sure.
So we worked hard for it.
How old were you when you were doing this?
Probably, I started about, I guess, 12.
Okay.
12 to about maybe 14, 15, something like that.
Did you work in high school?
In high school, I would probably work on Saturdays, bagging groceries. I would also caddy at golf courses.
Okay.
But mostly I was involved in athletics, so I didn't get a chance to work after school.
Okay.
But
well, tell me about your involvement in athletics.
Well, I had two things I did.
I'm sensing it played a big role in your life.
What's that?
I'm sensing that it played a big role in your early life.
Yeah. Well, it did. It did. I probably spent more time doing that than I did studying. But anyway, I ran track in high school. I ran the half mile and the quarter mile, mile relay, and managed to, you know, earn a letter jacket. And it was kind of hard to do that in those days because they didn't give you those kind of things in those days for just showing up. What you had to do in Dallas to get a letter jacket was there were 8 schools, and you had to place first, second, third in your event in the city meet. Mm-hmm. to earn a letter jacket. So I did manage to earn one of those. I probably had more notoriety or interest in some of my Golden Gloves boxing. I fought as a young 135 pounder, and did pretty well. I won more than I lost, but I wasn't a great fighter, which was a good deal.
Right.
Because I wasn't encouraged to go on beyond that.
Right.
Yeah. Those are the two things I did.
Did you find that sports prepared you for anything that would come later in life, such as the military?
One thing I gained out of running track was that I probably gained an appreciation for staying in shape probably all my life. And I still, now 66 years old and still stay in pretty good shape. I think a lot of it started back then. And, you know, running is not necessarily a lot of fun. Some people don't like it.
Right.
And sometimes I had to really convince myself I needed to go do this.
Right.
But I think that part did. And the boxing part, I think I learned out of that was it was something I didn't really want to do. I didn't want to do beyond just playing around in high school.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I actually had some negative experience of it because boxing is I'm not too sure it's a good sport.
You know?
Well, I think it was good as a kid in fighting the Golden Gloves, but I see what's happening in the sporting in the professional world. I'm not sure it's good. I'm not too sure.
Too much money, too much brutality.
Well, money. I wonder. Sometimes I even wonder if fights aren't thrown. It's good for the kids that are perhaps don't have a lot of opportunity in front of them. That part of it I do like. It's just that I just worry about the senior side of it.
Right. Okay. Tell me about your education. What kind of student were you?
High school was not a particularly good student. And I think the reason is I spent more of my time concerned about what was outside the classroom, you know,
right.
To go have a good time and those kinds of things.
Typical teenager?
Yeah, probably. And I probably was more typical than I thought I was. I come to find out later on that most of the boys were quite pretty much like me.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate enough, I think, in those days, the education system in those days seemed to have done a pretty good job of taking kids like me that didn't necessarily want to be good students,
mm-hmm.
and taught us in spite of the fact we might not have wanted to have been taught well. And so I think I was well served by that. Probably a good example is the way I treated things. Like, I remember having an assignment one time to go read Shakespeare's Julius Caesar.
Okay.
Well, after about two or three pages of Shakespeare, I just didn't like the dialogue. I like to read things directly about what's happened,
right.
Not have a couple of people talk about in some fictitious manner. So after about two or three pages of that, I went down to the library and picked up a book on Julius Caesar by Suetonius, or one of his peers, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so I probably knew a lot more about Julius Caesar than anybody else did.
Right.
But I didn't know things like friends roaming the country, because that's something that Shakespeare invented, right?
Right.
His dialogue. So so I may probably see on it or something like
uh-huh.
that. And that's kind of the way my high school was. I pretty much educated myself the way I wanted to be educated, I guess.
Did your parents emphasize education? Was that stressed in your household?
Well, my mom passed away at a fairly early age. She was a teacher. And so my dad remarried, and neither one of them had that kind of an education. And they stressed education. You got to do good. You get paddled if you make do bad, and that sort of thing. But it wasn't the kind of, real... nurturing type of thing that I provided my children, because by the time I had children, I knew how important it was.
Okay.
And so I probably didn't have a lot of encouragement on that, although all three of us went to college and then the other boys did.
Did they encourage you all to go to college, or was it something that...
Yeah, we were all encouraged, and they all paid our way through and everything. And we were all encouraged to go to college.
Okay. When you look back at your childhood, what do you see in your mind's eye?
What do I see? First of all, I'm really pleased with it. I think I had an interesting childhood. I had a fun childhood. I felt comfortable. My parents, I knew they loved me and were going to take care of me. Mm-hmm. And I felt I was just in a good incubator.
Mm-hmm.
I have pleasant memories of my childhood.
Okay. Okay. So in high school, and you're preparing to graduate, what are your thoughts? What year is this? This is
19. This was not, I graduated in 1956.
Okay, so 1956. What are your plans?
Well, now here's the problem. Now here you are, you're getting ready to graduate from high school.
Right.
Finally, it's dawning on you that this little world you've been living in is getting ready to change.
Right.
And all my friends were talking about going to Texas or A&M or Texas Tech or somewhere else. And here I have made no plans whatsoever.
Why not?
What's that?
Why not?
Well, I don't know. I really don't know why I was not ambitious. For some reason, I was not ambitious. It seemed like at an earlier age.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I ought to go to college.
Okay.
So I had a friend of mine that had a scholarship to go to East Texas, and I was good enough to probably marginally ran track and I get college, and I did. And so I did do that for a year. But that's why I left after a year, was because. Mm-hmm. I realized that I had not prepared myself. I didn't know what I wanted to be. I wasn't to be an artist. I wasn't really good enough to really be competitive in college track. And so that's pretty much why I left then. And it's hard for me to understand sometimes why I wasn't motivated.
Let me ask you about your art. When did you become interested in art?
I apparently was born with artistic ability. I could draw at an early age, and my mother was artistic, so I'm assuming I inherited some flair for being able to draw and sketch and things like that. But it's pretty pedestrian when you compare it to people that are real artists. And it takes more than just mechanical skill to be a good artist. You have to have like a vision, or you have to be able to have creativity, which I didn't have that creativity, artistic creativity.
And you're still an artist today, though.
However, my granddaughter can draw and paint circles around me today.
Uh-huh.
So I am still interested in it, and still draw and paint and things like that.
Okay.
But you can't do it as an occupation. I wasn't good enough to do it as an occupation.
Did you stop drawing and painting?
No, I continued.
All your life?
Mostly cartooning, and when meetings were going real slow, I'd be sitting there. My secretary, one time for my birthday, she took some pictures that I'd drawn on one of my things, and she had it put onto a coffee cup.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, they're cute little drawings, so you really thought they were pretty neat.
Did you draw in Vietnam?
No. Now Vietnam, we were just. I got over to Vietnam at the time when the real. I was the first Marine Corps OCS class to have been trained specifically for Vietnam, and we got over there just when all the big battles were taking place. It was. We had almost no time for.
Right.
Yeah. Anything like that.
Okay. Okay.
Just.
Tell me about after East Texas. What did you do? You spent that year there.
At East Texas?
Yes.
Well, I ran track okay. at East Texas, and I really participated in the campus life. You know, okay. went to the student union building, you know, dated some nice and young ladies down there, and played ping pong in the student union building. And I actually did very well in school at East Texas. I made better grades in college than I ever made in high school. And I was also in the ROTC, Air Force ROTC.
Okay.
And so...
Why did you get into that? How did you get into that?
Well, I was in ROTC in high school.
Okay.
And my brother had been in ROTC at SMU, and it just looked like something I probably ought to do.
Okay.
And even then, for some reason, I didn't have a vision beyond staying in ROTC and getting commissioned in the Air Force, and I just didn't have the vision for some reason.
Well, so you were in ROTC in high school?
In high school.
Okay. Why didn't you...
Well, Woodrow Wilson High School in Dallas in the 50s had the biggest ROTC unit of any other school in the country.
Really?
It was a very huge. I mean, we had something like, I would guess, 3 or 4 battalions of ROTC students.
Wow.
You had to take ROTC. It was kind of like A&M.
Okay.
Up until you got to be senior, then you could take PE.
Right.
But so it was kind of mandatory.
Okay.
And I really didn't get too impressed with the Army in ROTC. They had the old World War II olive drab uniforms. Eek. And the Marine Corps had these real sharp-looking white hats and uh-huh. blue trousers with a red stripe. And, boy, it looked a lot more appealing to me.
But you were in the Air Force.
Yeah, well, in college, yeah. That was a different story because that's the only thing they had there.
Okay. So in high school, you were in the...
High school, Army ROTC.
Army ROTC.
And at East Texas, it was in the Air Force ROTC.
Okay. Did you have aspirations to fly?
Not really. What I mean is I kind of did, but it was not really a drive. And I think you have to have a burning. Flying an airplane is extremely dangerous. And you have to be good intellectually. You have to have nerves of steel. It's a different animal. I have so many friends that are pilots, and I'm telling you, it is a very challenging thing to do, flying, and particularly a jet aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very challenging. And so I never really had the real... I sort of had an ambition, but not a big... But they taught us aeronautics, though. I mean, I learned how airplanes fly and mm-hmm. that sort of thing, which is the very first year that they go through all that.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really have an ambition to be there.
Okay. So you were there at East Texas for 1 year.
Right.
What did you do? Why did you leave, and what did you after?
Well, I left because I realized I wasn't going to do art. Wasn't going to be a career field.
Okay.
I also, those were the days that, and I realized I wasn't going to ever be a track, star in college. And those were the days that you had to go in the military anyhow. And since I didn't really know what I wanted to do, I knew I had to change majors. And what am I going to change? I'm going to be an engineer, mm-hmm. I'm going to be an accountant. I didn't really know what I wanted to be. So it looked to me like I might as well go ahead and get the military obligation out of the way. And besides that, I probably would be better off getting away from home and finding out who I really was. And that's kind of what my, I think my thinking, that's when I began to start to grow up.
Okay.
I realized I had to go do something,
okay.
you know, on my own, not just... depend on someone else to help me
right.
through this.
This is the spring of 1957?
Yes. It was September of 57.
Okay.
Is when I went in as Muslim.
Okay, tell me about going into the military. How did you choose? And
the Marine Corps?
Marine Corps, and why?
Well, the Marine Corps is interesting because, I had 2 or 3 friends that had already gone in, and I had a couple of friends that were close friends that were getting ready to go in then.
Mm-hmm.
And and like I told you before, the uniforms and all the things, the Army just didn't appeal to me.
Okay.
And the Marine Corps had kind of seemed to me like a reputation and a history and things that seemed to be missing in the other ones, and I went in for that reason.
Okay.
Principally.
How did your family feel about this?
Well, they realized I was kind of fumbling around, and they thought it was the right thing to do for me. My dad was more than willing, keep paying to have me go down to East Texas, or if he wanted to go to SMU or mm-hmm. wherever I wanted to go to school, he was willing to help me do that. It's just that he realized I needed to go do something on my own.
Okay.
And he saw me as not the growing up process alone.
Okay. How much did the Korean War affect your decision to go into the military?
What the Korean War was seemed to be the it affected me a little bit, and the effect it had. I remember throwing a paper out, and I remember I had this one customer that used to come out and get the paper a lot, and I remember seeing on the front pages, you know, Korea, but I never really read the front pages. Mm-hmm. I just saw the, you know, the headlines on it, and this guy asked me one time, "What do you think about what's going on in Korea?"
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't know how to answer him because I just threw the papers, right? But I got to reading the newspapers.
Okay.
after he'd said that, and I began to sort of see what was going on in Korea, and from that point on, I think that started my interest in newspaper reading.
Okay. So tell me about your first experience in the Marine Corps when you went in 57 and you go into basic. Where did you go? What did you do?
Well, I went to San Diego.
Okay.
To the Marine Corps Depot in San Diego, and I guess it was pretty much exactly what I expected it to be. I was told it was going to be tough, and it sure was.
Mm-hmm.
I went in a very interesting period of time. Two things that happened, cultural events. Mm-hmm. One of them, I don't know what the exact time frame was, but 2 to 3 months before, there had been some young Marines had been marched into a river in South Carolina at the boot camp in Parris Island, and to their deaths. That was an interesting thing that occurred. Secondly, there was a movie that had just came out with Jack Webb called The D.I., and we all got to see that in boot camp. You know. And the difference between what we've seen in Jack Webb and what we've seen in our real D.I.s, and these D.I.s in those days, I think it's different today, but their vocabulary was very, very different. It was maybe every third or fourth word looked like a word you might find in a dictionary somewhere. But they had a way of taking slang words and real words and combining them and creating their own little jargon that was quite unique.
Okay.
And I remember that pretty much. They were pretty tough on us.
Really? How did you do responding to that military lifestyle?
I probably was a natural kind of person for that sort of life. I was very athletic, energetic, and they had a lot of fun with people. They had a lot of fun with me particularly because I'm very small, 5'6" tall, and I was the smallest person in the platoon, but I also was the only track man of the platoon too.
Right.
So they would have a lot of fun. They would have three platoons go in series together, and I was in a series. It was 295, 296, 297, and the DIs have all kinds of bets back and forth about who's got the best platoon, the fastest platoon, or whatever. And one DI made a bet one time. He said, "I'll tell you how good my platoon is. I'll take my smallest feather merchant." That's what they call the little guys, feather merchants.
Feather merchant?
Feather merchant.
Feather merchant.
Feather merchant.
Okay.
"I'll take my smallest feather merchant. I'll run him against your fastest man. I'll bet my guy will win." Well, of course, you know, I was a track guy,
right?
And of course, I didn't win, you know. So that was kind of fun to have with the. And I was also a boxer, so I won an outstanding boxer trophy there. So they had a lot of fun using me to win their little bets.
Were you? Did you know about the lore of the Marine Corps before you went in? And when you went in, did they kind of indoctrinate you into here's what a Marine is?
Oh, you mean when I was in boot camp?
Well, before you went in boot camp, did you hear about the Marine Corps and the legend of the Marine Corps?
Well, I think I knew that. I think, you know, the Marine Corps hymn is grade school.
Right.
You know, so you hear that, and so you knew the Marine Corps was distinctive. But all the other branches had their, you know, their song as well. But the Marine Corps probably was distinctive.
Okay.
And I certainly didn't know the history of the Marine Corps.
Okay.
But I did. I knew enough about it to have a positive image of it.
What about once you were in basic? Did they give you a history of the Marine Corps?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I would say that maybe the thing that even differentiates the Marine Corps from the other branches of the armed forces is the history part. Even during Vietnam, when they had to reduce the number of weeks that the boots were going through boot camp, the Marine Corps taught that history, those history courses. They would never let those not be taught. And the reason they did that, and it seems to have paid off, is that they want to instill in every young Marine a knowledge that there were Marines that came before you, and the reason you're here today was because of what they did. There's going to be Marines going to come after you, and they're going to be coming after you because of what you do now.
Right.
And they seem to, and the whole idea is to make you feel like you're part of something much larger than yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were very good at being able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Every kid I ever knew, I've seen very few. There are some that have negative views of the Marine Corps that were in the Marine Corps, but I would say that for every one of those, there's got to be several thousand others that have a very positive view of what the Marine Corps is and what it did for them.
Right. What was your typical day like there in San Diego?
Well, it seemed to me that I think when we first got up, we took off and did a run. We'd run that 2 or 3 miles and run the grinder,
mm-hmm.
have breakfast. Then you would go to classes, and I had lots of classes. And then you do field activities during the afternoon. And it depended on what kind of... what phase of training you were going through, because when we were in rifle range, it was a lot different. And on the rifle range, you know, snap in, you know, do the practice firing in the morning, then do the real firing in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it depended on exactly what phase of training you were in. But I'd say it was kind of, you always did your physicals in the morning.
Okay.
Always.
Tell me about the classroom education at that time. What did they teach you? Was it like, here's how you shoot, here are company tactics, platoon size tactics?
I'm trying to remember back, it was pretty much the whole thing. First of all, the Marine Corps has a little book called the Marine Corps Guidebook. That's the first thing they give you in this bucket issue. Mm-hmm. That, and the bucket issue is kind of an interesting thing to talk about, because when you walk into boot camp, first thing you do, you walk into civilian clothes, right?
Right.
Well, they got to get you acclimatized. So the first thing they have to do is they've got to give you the stuff that you need. They, you know, inside that bucket is, you know, soap and brushes and rifle cleaning gear and all kinds of other things that you need mm-hmm. to do your job. But to be honest with you, the most important element in that bucket issue is the bucket itself. Because that bucket was used to carry sand, water, sit on, you know, you put it on your head and bang a stick around it to get your attention, whatever it took. So the bucket was very important.
Right.
But the other interesting thing that the second thing you would get your bucket issue is they got to get you something that's green and that you can button up at the collar so everybody knows it's your boot. Third thing they do is they want to take the last element of individuality away from you, and that is they take you and they give you a haircut.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about a serious haircut here. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about just, you know. And these barbers, and these barbers are great. And I don't know if you'd really call them barbers. They're more like a person shearing sheep as opposed to a barber. And they really enjoy the guys who walk in with big, long haircuts. Hey, look at this one here. You know, take one big rip down the middle, and some guys got long hair. You can kind of imagine what you have here, right? Uh-huh. These guys enjoyed what they were doing. And those of us were standing, waiting in line like sheep, waiting to get sheared. You know, we thought it was funny, too, to be honest with you,
uh-huh.
even though we knew we were getting ready to get up there.
Uh-huh.
That was an interesting introduction.
Did you have longer hair?
No, I did. I had short hair for good reason. I knew what they were going to do.
Okay.
And I wore a flat top anyhow, so it was not a big deal. In fact, they used to get upset with guys like me. Ah, look, this is not even any fun, you know?
Right. Okay, so your typical day, you have a classroom experience. Tell me about your field exercises in the afternoon. What were they teaching you in basic?
Well, in basic, in boot camp, Marine Corps boot camp is principally not really involved too much in attack. They want to teach you to shoot a rifle there. They want to teach you, I don't think we got maps or anything like that there. I think it's mostly, they're drilling you on mostly equipment and how to clean your rifle, how to fire the rifle, hand grenades, machine guns, the things that you needed the tools of the trade, so to speak. And it was all based on what was in this Marine Corps guidebook, which I thought was very good. I still have my Marine Corps guidebook on my shelf. And all tattered and dog-eared by now, but I mean, it's all in there. Every single piece of equipment we would use, how to do a shelter half, how to put your pack on, how to pack it up, and what your mess gear was all about, and all those kinds. The basic ideas of what you had to have to do that. The real training to be a Marine rifleman took place after boot camp.
Right.
What they call the individual training regiment. That's where you learn tactics and things like that.
How did you evolve as a person? Did you find yourself becoming more of a leader in basic, or did that come later?
I don't think I found myself as really a leader in the... Well, maybe it's not really true. The fact that like I said, they give you the what they call the GCT, General Classification Test. The fact that I got that General Classification Test was up real high in the in the score there. And the fact that I was singled out of all the 75 people on platoon, I was the only one singled out to be interviewed for the Naval Academy, and I was the only one, I think, in my platoon that had any college before. Then I was kind of set aside sort of as a person that more likely was that people looked to but I don't think myself, I saw myself as a leader. I think other people may have seen that, but I'm not sure I did.
Okay. How long was boot camp?
I think it was 10 weeks.
Okay. What did you do after this 10 weeks? Where did you go?
Well, 10 weeks, got to go home for a couple of weeks to go to Christmas. And then we went to the infantry training regiment at Camp Pendleton.
Okay.
This is where we really learned the tools of the trade about being a Marine rifleman.
Okay.
And I don't remember as much about that probably as I do about boot camp. I just do remember we spent a lot. We probably spent more time in the field physically in ITR than we did in the classroom. I mean, we'd go to the classroom, learn maybe map reading or something like that, small unit tactics, but then they'd send you out in the field. You spent most of your time out there, and even the classes were conducted out in the field.
How did you do?
Pretty well. I mean, I would say I was in both boot camp and ITR. I would guess I was up in the top 70%, 75% or less.
Okay. Can you describe what you would do there at ITR? Your typical day there at ITR and really some of the things that they were teaching you. This is in 1958.
Right. 1958. Right. January 1958. Well, the things are basically, like I said, I think it's mostly they taught small unit tactics. They would teach. They teach basic map reading. Although I remember very little of basic map reading, and I remember all of it from OCS.
Okay.
But none in for some reason do I remember from ITR. We learned the basics of how Marine Corps organization worked. The fire team, the four-man team, the 13-man squad, how the platoon is organized and the company. We learned what it was like to be a rifleman in a platoon-sized organization. Pretty much.
Looking ahead briefly, when you were an officer in Vietnam, how much did that training there at Pendleton help you be a better officer?
That's an interesting. I've heard other enlisted men say it differently than maybe I feel. I felt like being an ex-enlisted man would be a big benefit to me when I went got commissioned. I'm not too sure it was. What I think it probably was beneficial in the long run because I did know what it was like being an enlisted man. But I think for a short time initially it might have been a disadvantage because my Marine Corps experience was as an enlisted man, whereas a typical officer coming in from college had no experience like that. So I may have tended to identify more with enlisted men and their issues and so on, maybe more so than I should have initially.
Okay.
Because eventually, I mean, it wasn't very long, like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, I realized that the difference between being an officer and an enlisted man is such a world of difference because I had responsibility and authority. And anything that happened to my platoon, I was responsible for it, good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you're an individual enlisted man,
right,
very different.
Right.
So I think that sometimes I think it was wasn't a disadvantage necessarily, but it wasn't, you know, it caused you maybe to you had to really think who you really were, because it's a big difference.
Tell me about your instruction at Pendleton. What was the quality of instruction?
You mean as enlisted man?
Yes.
I thought it was well done, and I'll tell you who it was done by. It was done mostly by the Marines who had been PFCs and corporals in Korea. These were all the Korean War guys, and they had seen combat. They understood what it was all about, and they had a saying there at Camp Pendleton that I thought was very appropriate. It said, "The more you bleed, or the more you sweat in peacetime, the less you bleed in war." And they really pushed that concept to us.
Did they talk to you about their experiences in Korea?
Yeah, they did. They talked about things like they ran into. You know, when they were talking about a particular set of tactics or something, they'd say, you know, we're teaching you something that we're not telling you this is the way it's going to work because you don't know what's going to happen once the thing really takes place.
Right.
And this is some things that happened to us.
Right.
So that you get the idea, this is the plan, this is the idea, this is what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it may not work that way once you actually get out there, because you have no idea what the other guys are going to do.
Right.
I think they did that very well.
Okay. What about the weapons training that you... I know you had basic training there in San Diego, but what about at Pendleton?
At San Diego, they taught us... the biggest thing we did there was learn just to fire the pistol, the rifle, and I think those are the two things we learned to fire there. We got into machine guns crawling under the barbed wire with machine guns firing over you. Those are the things we did at San Diego or at Camp Pendleton.
Okay. What were you best at?
Was I best at?
Yes, weapons-wise.
Well, it wasn't drill because I was a little short feather merchant, always on the end, having to take big steps to try to keep up with everybody. So it wasn't marching. I wasn't very good at that. I was probably a good field marine. I liked marching up and down the hills, and I enjoyed that.
Okay.
I really do. Okay. And I would have been a very good rifleman in a what we called a rifle squad or rifle platoon.
What about weapons-wise? What were you best at with weaponry?
Well, on a rifle, I was a sharpshooter, which is the second grade. There's a marksman. You have to make 190 or whatever it was to make marksman. Then there's sharpshooter, then there's expert. Mm-hmm. I was always a high sharpshooter, never quite okay. Was good enough to be an expert.
Is this the M14 or M1?
M1.
M1. Okay.
Yep, all 9 pounds and something else in there.
Right, right. What about the other weapons? What were grenades and machine guns?
Yeah, we were taught grenades, and we've taught the basics on how to fire the 60-millimeter mortar, and also the 45 pistol, and the rocket launchers, 3.5 rocket launchers. And those were the same when we went to Vietnam, too.
Really?
Yeah, some of those. The 3.5s. So.
Okay. How long was Pendleton?
I think it was about, about 6 weeks.
Okay. And when you emerged from Pendleton, what was your rank?
As a private.
Okay. And at that time, this is 1958, where were you going? Were you going to be given an assignment stateside?
Yeah, well, they ask you where you want to go.
Right.
You know, we all laugh about that, of course. But I thought I want to go exotic places. But I went to the Marine Barracks, Hawthorne, Nevada.
Okay.
To be an MP.
Oh, really?
And that's what I spent a year and a half as an MP. And it was a very important place to go because where I met my wife.
Right. Did you choose to be an MP? Did you train for an MP?
No, I was just assigned it. An MP, a basic rifleman, is a... would end up being an MP.
Okay. Why don't we take a break for a moment? Okay. Colonel Ray, we're going to stop for today, and we'll pick this up at another day. Thank you very much for your time today, sir.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Colonel Jim Ray. Today is March 26, 2003. It's a little after 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, at the Special Collections Library interview room. And Lieutenant Colonel Ray, you are in Allen, Texas. Is that correct?
Yes, I am.
Okay, very good. Sir, let's pick up where we left off from our first session. We had talked about a couple of things after we finished that session on the 11th of March. And you told me that you had a club foot and that you actually were still very active athletically with this impediment. And I thought that was very significant in the fact that it shows a lot about your early determination in life. And I wonder if you could comment on overcoming that.
Well, I pretty much remember it as, I think I was operated on when I was a child of about five. This was during the period of time, today they don't have to do as much surgically as they did in those days. In those days they thought they had to surgically correct the problem. So they basically moved some tendons across and took the Achilles tendon and lengthened it, some things like that, to mm-hmm. get the foot pointed forward and that sort of thing. Then they put me in a cast for, I would guess, several months.
Right.
And I remember actually starting to school wearing one of these little walking casts.
Right.
And I personally don't remember it really ever bothering me. Even with the cast on, I was still able to outrun most of the kids. So for whatever reason, I just think it was just a small... a little impediment that I probably had probably overcome as a young child, and It bothered me a little bit later on in life because, you know, you got a shoe, you got a foot that's a size smaller than the other and that sort of thing. But
yes, sir.
Other than that, I pretty much think I just ignored it and went on about my business.
Okay, okay. Well, where we left off, you had gotten orders to go to Camp Hawthorne in Nevada. And
at the Marine Barracks, Naval Ammunition Depot, Hawthorne.
Right. Tell me about that transition and what that was like for you.
Well, that was my first real, I guess you would say, job outside of being a teenager growing up. And I was a military policeman at the Marine Barracks Hawthorne. And in that kind of a job, basically, we stood what we call four-hour watches, or off 8 hours, and then another four-hour watch, like 8 to 12 in the morning, and then you get 8 to 12 again in the evening, or
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing.
Right.
And I worked my way up the ladder there, I started off the standing post, and I eventually ended up driving a pickup around the base in the evenings, watching over the base and so on.
Okay. How did you enjoy that work?
I enjoyed it because I felt like it was an important job that needed to be done, and it was interesting that they would entrust an 18, 19-year-old to do a job like that.
Yes, sir. What year was this?
This was in 1958.
Okay. How did you feel at this point in your life, you know, after having gone through NCRD at San Diego and then Camp Pendleton? Did you feel yourself as a real Marine and kind of in the esprit de corps that the Marines try to build within each Marine?
Oh, yes. I felt that pretty strongly then, and I think I was rewarded for, I guess, being that way because I was promoted pretty rapidly.
Okay.
Probably the most interesting thing that happened to me in Hawthorne was where I met my wife.
Okay. You want to tell me about that?
Well, that was interesting. I was always was born and raised in Texas, and I was a Southern Baptist, and I went to church like a lot of young kids did. And so I picked that back up again when I was in the military. And one morning I happened to meet a young lady at church, and that young lady eventually became my wife.
Okay. So you met her at church?
Yes.
Okay. So tell me, how long were you at Camp Hawthorne?
I was at Hawthorne for about a year and a half.
Okay. And where did you go from there?
From there, I was transferred to the Camp Pendleton, went right back to Camp Pendleton in California,
mm-hmm.
Transferred to the 7th Marine Regiment as a basic Marine rifleman.
Okay. And what were your duties there?
Well, my duties there, I was assigned to what they call a 106 millimeter recoilless rifle platoon. We had one of these large weapons, anti-tank weapons, essentially,
mm-hmm.
were mounted on a small, like a little platform that had a driver's seat and an engine assigned to it, and effectively you could take that that gun pretty much into combat that way.
Okay. And how long were you there at Pendleton?
I was there at Pendleton until September of 1960, and that's when my three-year enlistment was up.
Okay. Tell me about the mood at Pendleton when you went back. I assume this is in 1959 or 60?
Right, 59 and 60.
Okay. What was it like there at Pendleton during this time?
It was pretty much a peacetime mm-hmm. Marine Corps. There was very little on the national, international scene that would concern us. I mean, there were some issues in Cuba and some things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But principally, we were, it was pretty much a peacetime Marine Corps. And most of the people that were our officers and NCOs were people that had been in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty much what it was like in those days.
Did you have any aspirations to continue after your enlistment was up?
No. At that point in time, I was mostly interested in getting out of the Marine Corps, we had our daughter was there. We was interested in making sure she was born before I got out, and that helped a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was interested in going back to college.
Okay. And so when did you actually get out of the Marine Corps then?
Well, it was in September of 60.
Okay. And did you go back to college then?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Where did you go?
Well, I initially started back in California. We went to Santa Maria, California, to a small junior college called Hancock College.
Mm-hmm.
And it was close to Vandenberg Air Force Base. And
mm-hmm.
by that time, of course, I was a married man with a child. And I worked on the second shift, night shift, for General Dynamics Astronautics on the Atlas missile program.
Okay. Okay. Well, can you tell me about that work?
Well, that was interesting work. I started off as a warehouse man working in the issuing parts out, bringing parts in and stacking them on shelves. I was promoted to a job where I became the what they call the propellants coordinator,
mm-hmm.
sort of as an in-between conveyor or General Dynamics mm-hmm. and the Air Force to make sure that we had liquid oxygen, nitrogen, and helium on the Atlas missile pads at Vandenberg.
Okay. And tell me about your schooling at Hancock. What were you studying?
Well, I was majoring at that. I started to major in education, and but at that point in time, I was still working my first 2 years of school, so it really didn't matter too much. But I pretty much decided I was probably going to go into business. So I was really, that's where my orientation was. I was really trying to get my first 2 years of college out of the way.
Right. And were you going to transfer somewhere?
Yes. Well, I had to. And we eventually were going to transfer to somewhere in California, like mm-hmm. at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Yes, sir.
But at that point in time, it looked like it was probably the wise thing to come back to Texas.
Okay.
Where my family and home was. And so that's what we did.
Okay. So you're there for 2 years at Hancock.
At Hancock College in Santa Maria, California.
Okay, and so you came on back to Texas. What did you do?
Well, I came back to Texas, and once again, still had the same dilemma of a wife and child. And
right.
I started going to the University of North Texas. Well, it was called North Texas State University at that time. It's now mm-hmm. called University of North Texas. And I'd work for maybe 6 months or a year, and it took me about 3 years to get out of school that way, but I finally did.
Okay, so this will be in 65?
Right, yeah, this was in between the period about 63 to 65.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple questions about national events that were going on there. Tell me what you thought about President Kennedy.
Well, that was very interesting, particularly being in Dallas.
Yes.
Because at the time that national event occurred, I was actually working as a head accountant for a shoe manufacturer, shoe wholesaler called Graham Brown Shoe Company, and I happened to have been on Industrial Boulevard, which is about maybe 2 miles away from where the famous Triple Underpass event took place, and
yes.
We could actually hear the sirens and so on. Heard those anyhow, because Parkland Hospital was the place that any kind of incident like that occurred, they would take the wounded people to Parkland Hospital. So
right.
We didn't think much about it until we started getting phone calls in that day, and that was a very, very traumatic incident to go through. I'll tell you what is really sort of interesting, though, about my life.
Mm-hmm.
When I was going to, when I was doing one of the jobs where I was working during the day, I was attending SMU at night school,
mm-hmm.
and in order to go get my textbook, I had to go down and pick it up at a particular place.
Mm-hmm.
That place happened to be the Texas Scuba Repository.
Wow.
So in the year 1962, I went up to, I think it was the third floor of the Texas Scuba Repository to pick up my basic accounting book.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never seen the building or even thought about it in my life. And then, of course, a year and a half later, it becomes a very famous building.
Right, right. Wow.
That was a very interesting period of time.
Mm-hmm. How long were you there?
You mean at Graham Brown or?
Well, you were there until 19.
Well, I was there in Dallas either going to school or working during that period of time, and I was there until I graduated in June of 1965, and I was slated to go to OCS in September of 65. So during that period of time, I worked, I had a part-time job or a temporary job as an auditor for a battery manufacturing company.
Okay.
Auditing books and things, that sort of thing.
At UNT, were you in ROTC? Were you still pursuing the military?
No, I really had not thought about going back into the military. I was principal job was to get out of school, get my degree in accounting, pass the CPA exam, maybe go into law school, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty much what my reasoning was. However, I happened to have been strolling through the student union building one morning, and I happened to see a couple of Marines. And so, naturally, being an ex-Marine, I walked over to introduce myself to them. And lo and behold, one of these Marines was a captain with a big pair of naval aviators wings on, and uh-huh. I happened to have recognized him. He had been a neighbor of mine when he was a student at at the Oklahoma State University. In fact, he was a football player.
Right.
And, you know, so naturally one thing led to another, and that was pretty much how I ended up going back in the Marine Corps.
Okay, so he basically talked you into it that day?
We just sat down and, you know, and just talked initially, but we got to kind of talking about it. But here I was, a situation, I was now 26 years old, and I was, you know, I was about 4 years behind my contemporaries, if you want to get down to it.
Right.
So here I am sitting there now trying to figure how to jumpstart my life and career and so on. And we really took a look at it and said, well, this was an opportunity to basically get back on track with my peers, because I already had 3 years of active duty, which meant that I'd always be paid the highest that you could be paid at whatever rank that I was.
Mm-hmm.
I could effectively retire in 16, 17 years. I wouldn't have to do a full 20 year because I already had time in.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vietnam War was just starting, and I would probably be promoted very fast. And I was already sort of involved in the political scene by that time anyhow. I'd finally gotten to where I sort of understood, you know, how the political system really worked, you know, how, what conservatives and liberal positions and progressive and traditional and that sort of thing. So I pretty much was I guess you'd call it a pretty patriotic individual by that time anyhow. So all of that sort of kind of came together at the right time, I guess, in my life for me to make that kind of a decision.
Did national events help you along that way with the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy's death, and then the start of the war in Vietnam?
Yeah, it did. I think it just made me feel like that there were things that we as individuals sort of needed to do that were maybe even over and above our individual you know, interests and things like that. My family was very firm, particularly my father. He really just couldn't understand at all why I was going back in and volunteering to do something that a lot
right.
of people would not be interested in doing at all.
Right. Tell me about how your family actually reacted to you coming back into the service, and especially with the war heating up.
Well, my father was very, very concerned about that because he, you know, he realized that I was going to probably be in danger, and, you know, here I was, someone with a wife, and by that time, two children and so on, and they were very concerned about that, but they also knew, and my wife was very supportive of this. She understood the way I was and the kind of person I was, and that felt like her job was to support me in the things I needed to get done, and she would just have to go take the whatever chances were there.
Right. Okay. Can you make some comments about what your understanding was at the time of what was happening in Southeast Asia? This is right before... Or actually, this is after the Marines had landed at Da Nang.
Right, this was about 2 or 3 months.
Right.
After they landed.
I
think that my attitude was that, you know, the United States was a large power, superpower maybe even in that time, I guess you would have called it. And we sort of had treaty obligations with these people. We had the communist... international communist movement, or whatever you want to call it, was pretty much in full swing throughout the world. They were in every third world country, and anywhere there was any opportunity at all to exploit unrest or so on, you had communist movements there.
Right.
And I saw that that our country was in danger because we could not afford to have our allies, places where we needed to have ships be able to land and port and things like that, to fall to hostile governments, and I felt like it was an important thing for our country to maintain its position in the world. So
okay. That
was kind of the way I looked at it.
Okay. What did you think of Lyndon Johnson?
Well, I didn't vote for him.
Okay.
And, I did vote for him the first time. Believe it or not, I voted for the Kennedy administration, my very first election, and I guess I was kind of upset because the Nixon administration had let Cuba go to Fidel Castro, and I didn't really understand all the issues in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I voted for the Kennedy-Johnson, but by the time I finally finished college, I had begun to understand the difference between the two political parties and the system and that sort of thing. And I was, I respected Johnson, and he was a fellow Texan and that sort of thing, but I felt like he was on the wrong side of history, so to speak.
Okay. All right, so... You finished there at UNT, and you're going to go back into the Marine Corps, and you're going to get ready to go into OCS, you said.
Right.
Okay. Tell me about the transition. Did you go to Quantico?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Tell me about your transition over to Virginia.
Well, it was that is actually a very easy transition. for me because I was an ex-enlisted man, and I knew pretty much how the Marine Corps operated. And going back in the Marine Corps, it was almost like, oh, that 5 years had passed very quickly, and it was almost like I just picked back up where I'd left off. And I'd already been to boot camp, so OCS was just another boot camp, a little different, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The only interesting thing about it is I had been told that the ex-enlisted man had a higher dropout rate than the normal college kids for some reason. Huh. And the way I think it was oriented to begin with is the Marine Corps expected about a 20% dropout rate anyhow, and mm-hmm. I think that was even planned because they know there's some people that simply ought not to be in responsible positions, and the whole idea of OCS was to make sure they identify those people that mm-hmm. shouldn't be there. But the dropout rate was probably higher for ex-enlisted men because I guess they were already corporals or sergeants themselves like I was,
mm-hmm.
and they just, you know, maybe had been through this harassment thing before and weren't interested in doing it a second time after they actually got into it.
Right. How were you treated and accepted by the other Marines?
Maybe with some deference a little bit because I was a little bit older, one, and then number two, I was an ex-enlisted person, so they always looked to me to about how the things really work.
Right. Right.
So I was pretty much overly accepted, perhaps, by my peers.
Okay. How long did your OCS training last?
I think it was about 10 weeks.
All right. Can you give me some details about what your typical days were like there and the kind of training that you did go through?
Well, it was very, very physically demanding, and that was by choice also. We would... those are pretty strenuous. They called them hikes, but actually what you were doing was running pretty much for 15 miles up and down these Virginia hills. And it's interesting because we were going through in the fall, and there was a lot of rain, and you'd be going up and down these hills, and these tree roots, you wouldn't see them. You'd stumble over them and fall down the hills and so on.
Right.
And what I remember most about that was it was very physical, and then you'd go to classrooms and so on like that. One of the classes I remember probably the most was when they seemed like they'd always do this after a particularly grueling run.
Mm-hmm.
You would then go to what they called, a confidence course or some kind of thing, but it was a leadership type of thing where they would break you into four-man teams.
Mm-hmm.
And a four-man team is interesting because the Marine Corps, that's its basic organization. The very lowest organization of a Marine rifle organization is what they call a fire team, leader and three riflemen.
Right.
They break us down into four teams of four, and then they run us through four exercises, each one in turn getting to act as the leader. And, you know, they give you things like a rope that was 10 foot long and a couple of boards and some things like that, and you were supposed to figure out how to get across a body of water or something without mm-hmm. getting wet.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it wasn't even really a solution at all, but the whole idea was to observe how someone that was tired with blisters on the feet and so on could operate in either a leadership or a following capacity when they were, you know, unhappy and, you know, under stress and things like that. And that was the whole objective, was to see how people operate under kind of stress that, you know, sort of simulate what you might run into in combat.
How did you do?
I did real well. I mean, I felt like I, you know, it's once again, to me, I was always very active, what do you call it, physically oriented person anyhow, and
mm-hmm.
this was just another track meet or a football game or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did you find yourself as a leader?
Well, I feel like I was one of these kind of people who would probably be classified as someone who had pretty strong latent leadership skills, but they weren't the kind that were what I would call natural leadership skills.
Mm-hmm.
Well, natural leadership, I guess, are the kind of people who... ones that people tend to be drawn toward in, you know, in the school environment and those kinds of things. They have these magnetic personalities or whatever it's called. I don't think I was that kind of person. I was one of those that had that latent leadership that began to develop the leadership skills once I realized what was really involved in being a leader.
Right.
That was the way I pretty much looked at it.
What was the Marine Corps teaching you about leadership? You're trained to be an officer and you're going to lead men. So what are they telling you?
Well, they're telling you a lot of, I think the first thing they're telling you is that the most important person and people in your outfit are your people,
mm-hmm.
or your men, and you have to make sure that you're taking care of them and the concerns they have and the things that need to be done before you take care of yourself. You need to make sure they're fed first. You need to make sure they're sheltered first and all those kinds of things. Once all that's done, it's time to start worrying about yourself.
Right.
Because when you do that, basically your men are going to be taking care of you anyhow.
Right. Were you able to translate that into action over in Vietnam?
I think yes, I was. I believe that they did a – first of all, I probably had that natural instinct to begin with, but I think that it was further honed, of course, by the Marine Corps. And I think by the time I got to Vietnam, I had been pretty clearly understood about the relationship between officers and enlisted men. And having been an ex-enlisted man, it probably was a little easier for me to understand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me about the relationship with the men at OCS. You said you were pretty well accepted. Tell me what you thought about how you interacted with them, how they interacted with you, about your instructors and kind of what your instruction was, the quality of that instruction.
Well, interestingly, in contrast to boot camp, the sergeant, they call them sergeant instructors, not DIs, but
right.
Jobs were essentially the same. It was not quite the same as boot camp. Boot camp pretty much was oriented toward breaking a civilian down and rebuilding that civilian as a infantry rifleman.
Mm-hmm.
And in OCS, it was not so much oriented toward breaking you down and rebuilding you as something. It was pretty much, I think it was oriented toward the physical side of it, oriented toward trying to, I think, sort out the folks that didn't have the leadership skills that was going to be needed to lead other people in combat. As far as the other people, there was probably four or five other ex-enlisted men in my platoon of, I guess, approximately 70 people, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all looked upon pretty favorably by the I'd call them the college kids right out of college, because we had experience about how things worked. And the sergeant instructors, though, we got no slack from them, I can assure you, though. In fact, they even looked at us maybe even a little resentfully. Here we were, corporals and sergeants, just like they were, except
right.
We were in a lot different position than they were.
Right, right. Did these men, were they Korean War veterans and that sort of thing?
No, not at this time. These,
okay.
The Korean War people, well, now, the senior people, like the senior master sergeants on and maybe majors and above in the Marine Corps probably were Korean War people. But the ones that we dealt with were not, because they by that time the Korean War was 13
yes,
years before.
Yes, sir. Had any of them been over to Southeast Asia by chance?
Had I been? No, I had never been to South.
No, had they?
Oh, had they? No, because the war had really just started.
Right, right.
So we were my class, OCS class, was the very first class that had been especially recruited for the Vietnam War. In other words, it was expanded, and we all knew exactly where we were headed.
How did you feel about that?
Well, we were all ready for it. I mean, it's kind of interesting how the human mind sort of works, and I call it how we revert to gallows humor about certain kinds of things, and we would, you know, make up little ditties of songs that we were had sung as kids, you know, like Over the Mountain and Across the Sea. Well, we would make those up to where there's the VC over there waiting for me and that sort of thing.
Do you remember any of those songs?
Oh, yeah, I remember them all. Still remember them.
Can you recite any of them?
Well, Over the Mountain and Across the Sea, there's the VC waiting for me, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh, okay. Anything
else? We had a lot of fun with those kind of things. We all knew what was going on, and we'd all volunteered. It wasn't like anybody had been pressed into doing it. We all felt like it's something we needed to do.
Right.
And, you know, we didn't talk much about politics or anything like that. A few of us did. A couple of my good friends were sort of like I was. They were pretty knowledgeable about the political scene and so on, but most of them were not. They were just kids that were doing what they thought they needed to do.
Right. Well, on that note, tell me what kind of specific training they gave you for Vietnam.
Well, at OCS, the training was pretty much the similar kind of training you would go through in boot camp. They taught you the basic, the rifle, the rifle range and fire, the pistols, machine guns, and the kinds of weapons that you would use in an infantry organization. And then you went through, you know, the most important thing probably the Marine Corps sends you through is Marine Corps history. That's one thing they will never, ever shorten up any kind of a crisis situation. They want to turn out somebody that understands the history of the Marine Corps and understands that they have a responsibility to make sure that the history of that Marine Corps continues on.
Right.
And history is very important, and like I said, the physical part of it. And you'd get into some light tactical things where we'd run through some tactical formations and things like that. But principally it was the weapons and that sort of thing.
Okay. How were you with the weapons?
I was a sharpshooter. That's the second highest.
Okay.
With weapon, I always was a very high sharpshooter. A couple of times I shot expert, but most of the time I was always a high sharpshooter.
Okay. What was your weapon of choice there at OCS? What did you like the best?
Which weapon?
Yes, sir.
Well, I'd say probably the rifle. I probably enjoyed firing. We fired the M14 in boot camp.
Right.
In OCS. I fired the M1 in boot camp.
Right. Did you prefer the M14 over the M16?
Well, I never fired the M16.
Oh.
The M16 didn't come into Vietnam until after I'd already left.
Okay.
And then in the first couple of years, the M16 had some real, real problems.
Yes, it did.
But I think that in time, the M16 became an outstanding weapon.
Okay. So what other things do you want to talk about OCS? I know this is a pivotal time in all Marine Corps officers' careers.
Else? I think it's interesting that you do form some very strong relationships because, I mean, these guys, you know, the whole idea of the Marine Corps is to bond people together, because when you get into combat, it's that bonding that really makes the difference about, you know, getting things done.
Yes, sir.
We just had reunion June of last year of my OCS class, and it was amazing that we had I think it was probably about 400 that were in the class overall in two or three of the platoons, and 150 of them with their wives showed up at this reunion.
Wow. What was it like to see them again?
But that was interesting, very interesting. First of all, the most interesting thing about it was the fact that these people had all gone off, and probably three-quarters of us went off into combat jobs as platoon commanders, as aviators, or whatever, or battery commanders or something. And to get to listen to the war stories and stuff like that of people we hadn't seen, because we didn't know where they were. We all just disappeared off into all these large Marine Corps organizations, and most of us never ran across one another again.
Right, right.
And it was the first time to get to see these people and then hear the stories that they did. And it was particularly interesting when we went to the Vietnam Wall. And because we have probably about 30 some odd of our people on that wall, and that was a pretty trying moment, much more so than we expected.
Yes, sir. We'll talk about that later when we talk about the memorial itself. So after you finished OCS, where did you go?
Well, I was then assigned. I got the MOS, so that's the military occupation specialty, of a tank officer.
Okay.
And the people like the aviators, tankers, artillery, engineers, people that had skills that were other than riflemen. The rifle platoon commanders were already ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
But those of us that had these other occupations, we went on for further training. And mine was at Camp Pendleton at the tank officer school at the old Del Mar camp, which is right outside Oceanside, California.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went through another, I think it was about 2 months of training about, you know, effectively how you shoot a tank, fire a tank, maintain a tank, keep a tank going, and then how to run a tank platoon.
Did you say 2 months?
I think it was a couple of months.
Okay.
Two and a half months or something like that. It wasn't too long.
Okay. Was this in early 1966?
Right. This was probably in around June, July of 66.
Okay. Did you choose to be a tank officer, or were you assigned to that position?
No, I asked to be a tank officer.
Really?
I initially wanted to fly, but at the age of 26, I was my eyesight was now 20/26.
Okay.
I just wasn't quite good enough to get to fly. They would have let me been what they call a radar intercept officer, fly in the back seat of a Phantom. But I wasn't interested in just riding in an airplane. I wanted to fly one, so I'd rather drive a tank than be in the back seat of an airplane.
Okay, all right. And tell me about the tank training then. What kind of things were you taught?
Well, we were taught basically the you know, how each of the weapons worked on the tank. We learned how to maintain them, which is extremely important, and something it's a 50-ton vehicle and that sort of thing. And we learned basic tactics of tanks, how you, particularly for a tank commander, the thing about us, we would end up, when we went to the field, you end up being not only a tank platoon commander with four other tanks, but you've got to command your own personal tank as well.
Right.
And just as another tank commander. So we had to learn all of the, we had to learn to drive the tank, shoot the tank, had to load with the loader. We learned all the jobs of all of the crew, and then, like I said, the basic tactics involved in what happens when you get ambushed, what's the type of reaction you need to take, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And those things really came in handy later on.
Were they training you for conventional war in South Vietnam, basically?
I think they were. I think they trained us. I think for the most part, we were trained about a conventional war. This is what happens when you acquire a target, and mostly it's going to be another tank or something like that. Mm-hmm. However, they also recognized that. And remember, they had very little experience themselves at this time. This was the war had only been going on for just about a year.
Yes, sir.
And so a lot of the experiences that later on we would they would talk about in the schools was not really available yet. But however, they also talked a lot about what happens when you do get ambushed and short range things with like RPGs and things like that. RPGs being the little rockets that the Viet Cong used mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
Yes. Yes. What was the most feared enemy weapon that they taught you that would that could take out the tank?
Well, that was the one that we worried most about. Anything that had the ability to, I guess it's what they call these ogive rounds with an ogive round is one where all of the where it's manufactured so all the power gets at a certain point and it has the ability to drill through a large. A metallic object and send shards of metals throughout the inside of the tank. Those are the ones we were most worried about.
Mm-hmm.
Although in reality, when we got there, you know they did such a poor job of shooting them at us. We could see them coming, and you know very few people really got hurt with them.
Right. What would you say was the tank's strengths and weaknesses?
Well, the strengths of it, of course, are the. In the kind of combat we fought, the biggest strength of the tank was the fact that we had those, what we call canister rounds. These are the rounds that were effectively like big, large shotgun rounds. They were each pellet probably the size of about four or five times the size of a BB. And we really used those a lot because most of the times we would get attacked or ambushed from where people were behind a hedge grove or something. And, you know, when you fired those canister rounds out there, whatever was behind the hedge grow was going to be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
That was its strength. The weakness, of course, was that we were in rice paddies and in jungle areas, and the roads were mined, and so you had to be very careful where you took the tank because you could hit a mine. You also had to be careful going through rice paddies. It better have sandy bottom. In fact, we had a long stick sometimes, so I wasn't sure. I would go out and get off my tank, get out in front and stick that rod right down through that paddy water to find out what kind of what was under there. If it was mud under there, you might not get through that paddy.
Did you find that a hindrance to tank operations in Southeast Asia?
Oh, it was a big hindrance. We were probably nowhere near as effective as we could have been, but on the other hand, we were very effective because there were places and times that the infantry absolutely had to have us.
Right.
So, we would carefully figure out how to get in there. Sometimes we would be taking their barges and getting across rivers in barges or whatever we had to do
mm-hmm.
To get us in there. But there were times when they needed us.
Right. Okay. What version tank was this that you were training on?
Well, the M48A3. And the M48A3 was what they called the patent tank.
Mm-hmm.
And the A3 version was, in effect, the version where they had taken the turret off of the M60 tank that the Army had. And it imposed that on top of the M48 chassis, and on top of that was a cupola. So it was kind of a composite of the M60 and the older M48.
Okay. So tell me these 2 months. Any particular incidents come to mind that you remember specifically when you think back about that time?
Well, probably not. Maybe not incidents so much, but one of the things that did take place was the. Commanding officer of the tanks was a guy that was a captain at the time named Joe Winter,
mm-hmm.
and he and I ran across each other many times later on in the Marine Corps. I'd been to Vietnam for about 3 months when he came over.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to take over a tank company, and so he knew I was over there, and he came to my platoon, and I took him out in the field once with me. I had used him as my loader, mm-hmm. so he could, you know, kind of get some idea what it was like out in the field before he took his own company over.
Right.
And then he and I ran into one another several other times. We both got selected to be data systems officers, so we both got trained at Shepherd Air Force Base in Texas, and basic computer operations and so on. And we ended up at El Toro together a few years later. He was the director of the computer center for the station. I was the director of the computer center for the wing.
Huh, okay.
Interesting, right out of the tank school.
Yes, yes. Okay, so after you finished at Pendleton, training on the tanks, were you going to Vietnam at this point?
Right. My next stop was to go to Vietnam.
Okay. How did your family feel about this, knowing that that's exactly where you were going?
Well, that was pretty tough. My wife, of course, my wife's parents lived in California, and she was staying with them during the period of time I was in training,
mm-hmm.
and I would go up there on the weekends and so on. My kids, they'd even come down and see me every so often. But she stayed there with her parents, and effectively, she had known a long time ago what was going on, so she just figured that religious lady figured that whatever was supposed to happen was going to happen.
Okay. How about your mom and dad?
Well, same to them, I guess. They were probably even more concerned.
Yeah. Okay. How did you feel about it? Were you eager, or were you reticent about going into war?
Well, I think to some extent, some of it maybe. I don't want to use the wrong word, but I mean, exciting is not the right word, but it was an adventure of some. You know, I was getting ready to go through, and it was the same adventure that the millions of other Americans had gone through, or hundreds of thousands, or whatever the number really is. And I just figured I was just another part of American history.
Okay. Did you find that true amongst your fellow Marines?
My fellow Marines. You know, it's interesting. We probably never talked much about it. I think everybody that I, for the most part, the people that I ran into, we never really talked about that. So it was an accepted thing that you did.
Mm-hmm.
We were just all doing kind of what we were sort of thought that was our job, duty, or whatever you want to call it to do. We didn't remember. This was at the very start of the war,
yes.
Back in 66, 67, where mm-hmm. a lot of the, I guess, more nastier politics over the Vietnam War had probably not begun.
Right.
But I mean, there was politics over it, but certainly not the kind that came later.
Right, exactly. When were you supposed to deploy over there to Vietnam?
Well, I went right out of the tank school. I took a two-week leave and then went right over.
Okay. When was this?
This was in August of 66.
Okay, in August 66. Okay. Sir, why don't we take a break for a moment?
Okay, no.
Am I going again?
Some water.
Okay, sir.
Coffee.
Are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
Okay, so let's pick off. You know, you're getting ready to go over to Vietnam. You had 2 weeks off beforehand. Tell me how you prepared to leave your family and to go overseas.
Well, it was a little bit difficult in a way because first thing I had to do is get a wisdom tooth removed at Vandenberg Air Force Base. Well, that was interesting.
Okay.
Air Force doctor thought it was kind of funny for a wing lieutenant to get ready to go into combat is concerned about oral surgery as anyone else. But
right.
That took place, and we just, you know, had a good couple of weeks trying to, you know, get them all prepared for me to be gone for a year, and it was, you know, it was just another kind of thing we had to go do, so we were ready to go do it.
Okay. And tell me about your deployment and how you got overseas.
Well, that's okay. We took off out of, my flight took off out of Travis Air Force Base, and interestingly, one of my good friends from OCS, Andy Blinkle, was on that airplane, and a couple other guys were on the airplane from the tank school, and this is something that was kind of interesting how this worked out, was because two of these guys they had orders to the 3rd Tank Battalion up in around the DMZ area, and
right.
I didn't really understand, and none of us really did at the time, what the attack situation was in Vietnam. In any event, for some reason, my orders had gotten kind of confused. Instead of having orders to the 1st Marine Division or 3rd Marine Division or a tank battalion or so on, I had orders to the 1st Marine Aircraft Wing. Aircraft Wing. Well, that's kind of interesting because what's your tanker doing there? Well, anyway, to make a long story short, when I got to Vietnam, I was able to straighten the orders out. They sent me to the, even gave me a choice of what division I wanted to go to, and I selected 1st Marine Division. Well,
so,
those
so
guys went to the 3rd Marine Division, and they didn't come back alive.
Wow.
Their name was Philip Sauer and Lewis Dobbin, a couple of fine young men that I happened to have known pretty close to the tank school. Anyway, that's kind of what we went from. We took off from Travis Air Force Base, and we passed through Japan. In fact, we stopped at Japan, and believe it or not, a JAL airliner had crashed there two or three days before, and we went right by the hulk of that aircraft.
Wow.
Then we took off and landed in Okinawa, and Okinawa was where they got us ready to go south, what they call it.
Right. So you were with the 1st Marine Division, and what was your unit exactly?
Okay, well, when I got to Vietnam, and like I said, they got the orders finally straightened out.
Yes.
I went to the 1st Tank Battalion.
That
was, because I was a tanker, they asked me, you know, where are you supposed to go? You know, you have an 1802 MOS, which is tanks. So I went to the 1st Tank Battalion. At the time, it was in Chu Lai. So I got on the aircraft, C-130, and the back strapped a little canvas seat, and, you know, with a bunch of really important stuff like rations and eating and mail and things like that.
Right.
And got shipped down to Chu Lai.
Okay. Before we go there, sir, tell me about coming into country. Did you come into Da Nang?
About what now?
Did you come into Da Nang or did you fly into Saigon?
We came into Da Nang.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What was it like when you came in country?
Well, interesting. The first couple of days I was there in Da Nang, and that was my first opportunity to get a real look at what Vietnam looked like. Of course,
right.
I was looking at the urban environment as opposed to the countryside.
Right.
But even the urban environment was interesting because the majority of the houses that you would see are all made of natural materials, bamboo, thatched roofs, that sort of thing. And it's pretty it was, I would say, a big culture shock to see that kind of a scene, but when you're used to a first world country.
Yes, yes. What were your first impressions of Vietnam? What did you think?
Well, it was pretty hot and pretty humid, and we got there just about the time that the rains would start, so kind of got some idea what it was like. I had never been to Asia or had never really been out of the United States.
Okay.
That was my first real time to be away from civilization, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. On the flight over, were you with a lot of Marines, or were you all mixed branches?
It was, that's interesting. I think it was mixed branches.
Okay.
And it really was just a Northwest Orient flight, you know, with stewardesses and everything. It was just
right.
like a regular commercial flight.
Right. Okay. So how long were you staying in Da Nang when you first landed?
I was only in Da Nang for a couple of days, and then before I went down to Chu Lai, which is where the 1st Tank Battalion headquarters was.
Right. Okay. And so tell me, you boarded the C-130 and you took off down to Chu Lai. And tell me about arriving there and getting assigned, going to.
Well, interesting. Yeah. And when I got to Chu Lai, the adjutant of the tank battalion knew that I was arriving, so he came out in a jeep personally to come pick me up.
Huh.
And he was a pretty interesting fella because this he was an ex-enlisted man and had been temporarily promoted for the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, as I checked in and he took a look at my record book and that sort of thing, he happened to remember that I had a degree in accounting.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, that stuck in his mind. And a year later, when it came time for me to leave Vietnam, something can't happen to come across his desk, and he remembered that. The Marine Corps was looking for lieutenants with accounting degrees that thought they'd make good data systems officers.
Uh-huh.
I ended up, and that one, I guess, chance conversation ended up having a major impact on my life and career.
Right, right. Okay. So how did he treat you? Was he pretty welcoming when you arrived?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. They were glad. I was another young. They needed lieutenants, and they
yes.
needed a particular lieutenant for a particular assignment. They had a tank platoon at Chu Lai, and the rest of the company, it was in the Charlie Company, 1st Tank Battalion, and the rest of the company was up in Marble Mountain, and they had this one platoon down there watching over essentially the airfield, and they didn't have a platoon commander, so they were looking for me in particular.
And so that was that's where you would step into that, in commanding that Charlie Company?
A second platoon of Charlie Company.
Second platoon, okay. And so your duty was to guard the airfield there?
Initially. Initially they had us there pretty much deployed around the airfield as direct fire support in the event they ever got hit. We actually were there, you know, as a regular platoon to be used for deployments and so on if we were needed, and we eventually were used that way.
Okay. Tell me about approaching your men the first time and meeting them. What was that like?
Well, that was interesting because it was obviously the first time I'd ever done that in that kind of a capacity. And I first thing I did was sit down and had a real long talk with my platoon sergeant, a gunnery sergeant named Mr. Jones, a very fine staff NCO. Mm-hmm. And he and I sat down and just kind of hashed our way through the situation, what he felt like his strengths and skills and so on were, felt like what I was doing and what my role was, his role was. We sort of worked that out before I sat down with the platoon. And he was probably the right kind of person for a young platoon commander to get, because these are the guys that understand that these lieutenants coming in right out of Quantico are, you know, they really are green, because they've been trained well. They understand tactics and understand how to get people around the countryside with maps and compasses and how to work the radios and do all those kinds of things, but they're green in terms of how the Marine Corps operates.
Right.
Of course, the issue was I was an ex-enlisted man, so that made it a lot easier on both me and him.
Mm-hmm.
But once I'd done that, I then sat down and, talked to the troops, and I basically, laid out what my background and experience was, the idea, of course, for them to know who I was. And then I explained to them that as time passed, I'd get around to see each and every one of them individually and that sort of thing. And so that was pretty much the way I approached it.
They
kind of know who I was, and I would know who they were.
Were you nervous when you first talked to them?
Not really. I think I had, I had been a corporal already with people assigned to me, and I already had leadership experience
right.
to some extent. So it was kind of like something that they expected me to do and I expected to do, and I was ready to do it.
How do they treat you as far as, you coming in country and not having experienced anything of combat yet there, and they haven't been through periods of action? And
to be honest with you, it was probably kind of easy on me in a way, because they had been on one operation, but I don't think they'd been directly involved with it, and they had very little experience themselves.
Okay.
And so for the practical purposes, they were probably glad to see me. They were glad to have an officer that was there that they, felt like they could go to.
Right.
To intercede with them and things like that.
Right. I can imagine that did make it easier, that they had not been, months and months in combat.
I was just another, person in some way, just like, in fact, they probably saw me as more experienced.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Particularly because I was an ex-enlisted man.
What kind of tone did you try to set with them?
What kind of what?
Tone did you try to set with them as their leader?
Oh, you mean, I think to some extent my ex-enlisted experience probably helped a little bit. But I think that the thing, what I tried to see that, and I think I got better on this as time passed, of course. When you're a brand new second lieutenant, you don't know all the things you know as a captain or a major or something like that. But I think the tone I tried to set with them was that I wanted to make sure they understood that I was approachable, that I didn't want to be looked upon or consider myself to be superior to them in terms of as an individual, but that they understood my role and I understood their role, and I expected to be addressed as yes sir, no sir, and those kinds of things. So that's the way the Marine Corps always operated, and I wanted to make sure they understood that.
Right.
And I think it worked pretty well.
Okay. Tell me about your barracks and where you stayed.
Well, we didn't have any barracks.
Okay.
We were pretty much living in, initially we were in tents.
Right.
They're scattered around the airfield. And, you had nothing but a tent. We did have, pallets as a floor.
Mm-hmm.
But this was during the middle of the worst of the rainy season or the monsoon season. And, your showers pretty much were just, you just take your clothes off and step outside the tank, outside the tent, and get wet, come back in, soap down, and go back out and rinse off. And that was pretty much the way it worked.
Did you really do that?
Absolutely. We did that in the field a lot.
Uh-huh.
But, you have no opportunity. You're on the move a lot, and you pretty much have to take whatever is available.
Right, Right.
And it's all ice cold in there. Even the showers are ice cold out in the field.
Right, right. Okay, so you were in tents, and who were you rooming with there in the tent? Was this a large tent for the whole platoon?
Well, yeah, just a tent for the whole platoon. The gunnery sergeant, I just set up shop and went into the tent, you know, and pretty much, you know, away from the troops, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Not too far. We were right there with them.
Right. Okay. So tell me what your first assignment was, basically to continue to guard the airfield, or?
Well, yeah, and that was it. I'd say for about the first 2 weeks, that's basically what we did. And we actually got martyred a couple of times and things like that. And, you know, name was a big deal. But probably the only real significant thing that took place when I was at Chulai, and I was only at Chulai for, I would guess, a month and a half or 2 months at the most. Probably a month and a half, I guess. But anyway, I got an assignment to go support the Korean Marines.
Okay.
They were undergoing an operation called, I think it was Operation Lee, and it was down, I forget the exact name of the area, but basically we were to go down there and link up with them and support them in one of their operations. So they signed me, you know, my whole tank force, and then I took five Antoses. These Antoses are... A civilian would probably look at them and see that they were little tanks.
Right.
They really were small vehicles with 106 millimeter recoilless rifles attached to them, and they were used essentially for direct fire support or anti-tank roll or something like that. But they really were used just for direct fire support. They gave those to me. Also, I was given a big tank retriever and an infantry squad to accompany me down there, and we basically spent a couple of days fighting our way across. You know, rice paddies and hedge groves and stone walls and all sorts of things that go across country. There were no roads down there, so we had to just cut across country to get down there. And that was my first operation, and it was not a real... We ran into a few sniper actions and things like that, and that was the first time I ever actually got fired on.
Okay. Can you tell me about that incident?
Well, it was... I think the first time it happened was... that I can remember that was... It looked like two or three snipers and located in different spots, and they were firing on us. And I think some of them were aimed at me, and it could have been because I had these little bars flashing, you know.
Right.
I learned paint, and it didn't flash a light anymore. But anyway, I was wearing a flak jacket, tried to get down inside the tank a little bit so I could kind of, you know, watch what was going on and see where the fire was coming from, but not be quite so high up in the target. I couldn't get down in the tank because I had this flak jacket on. So I kind of learned there that flak jackets probably didn't work too good for tankers. Mm-hmm. Being able to get in and out of that little tiny tank commander's hatch.
Right.
Never wore another one after that.
Tell me about how you rode in the tank and exactly your position and all of that, how that worked.
Well, the way it worked for a platoon commander, first thing you have to do is you have to command your own tank. And a platoon commander or the tank commander sits up in the hatch, what they call the cupola. It's a... have a seat in the cupola, and you raise the cupola up so that you can stand on it, and so you're effectively exposed from, I guess, the waist up outside.
Right.
And down inside the tank in front of you is the gunner, the person that's got control of the big gun and the that sort of thing. And then the loader sits to the left of you, and he's the person that actually puts the ammunition inside the big gun and the 50 caliber machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
And the driver sits in the front of the... well, inside, down in the chassis part,
mm-hmm.
And it's and the when you talk about the tank commander's job, the tank commander's job is to see the target, see what's going on, and direct the driver to where to take the vehicle, and direct the rest of the crew.
Right.
Then if they are attacked or something, but effectively, the tank commander also has the ability to override things that the gunner can do. In other words, the tank commander can spin the turret himself or aim the gun, fire the gun, or do anything personally,
mm-hmm.
Overriding the gunner. And sometimes you have to do that because the gunner can't see everything. All the thing the gunner can do is see what's in front of him on this little reticle.
Right.
And if he's got a direct target and so on, well, then the tank commander leaves the gunner alone, of course.
Right.
There are many times the tank commander has to take control of the tank itself.
Okay.
But then as a tank commander, you got the other four vehicles to worry about as well.
Right. Tell me about that setup.
Well, that's the big... The way it really sort of worked, at least in a place like Vietnam, was that because most of the battles, fights, or whatever we got into were pretty much all affairs where we were fired at with either sniper fire or maybe a B-40 or a RPG rocket or something like that, and we had to take immediate action, firing off canister rounds or something.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it kind of worked was that had a general idea of what you needed to do, and you'd sit down with your tank commanders, and they all understood what was happening. In my case, I always was the first tank because they could sort of take their cues from what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much the way a tank commander had to operate. It was kind of like the squadron commanders in a dogfights in World War II. You know, once you laid out and planned what you're going to go do, once the battle begins, so you're just flying your airplane by yourself and shooting at the enemy in the same way the tank commander.
Right. Okay. How would you travel up and down the roads? Were you in the front or in the back, in the middle?
But I usually pretty much was always in the front.
Okay.
Whenever I went, just on the grounds, because that's almost always the way it worked. The first tank was the one that was usually going to get involved in the action initially anyhow.
Right.
On the roads, we very seldom had too many problems on the roads because the engineers would usually sweep the roads we'd go on, and the very few that we would travel on. Most of the time, we were actually crossing sand dunes and the countryside. We tried to stay off the roads.
Right. Tell me how the tank operated in that environment. And you mentioned that a little bit with the rice paddies, but tell me about the weather and how the actual machine held up.
Well, to be honest with you, they held up really well. I don't think we experienced any, during my time as platoon commander, I don't think we had any kind of mechanical problems that caused us ever have to abort an operation or something like that. And one of the reasons was kind of the deal, I guess you would call it, I'd worked out with my platoon commander or platoon sergeant. He knew more about tanks or had forgotten more about tanks, and I was probably going to learn in that year that I was. The deal was he was to take care of the tanks from the point of view of maintenance and those kinds of things, make sure they were always supplied, they always were fueled, and
mm-hmm.
all those kinds of things. He did all that sort of thing behind the scenes for me, and I deployed the tanks to the field with the troops. And so we were in pretty good shape there. The only time you would run into trouble is if you did run into a mine, and I did run into one over
mm-hmm.
there, and that problem is if you get a track blown off,
right.
Then now you got to go figure out how to short track it. By that I mean, track is now broken, so you have to try to get it strapped around the sprocket, and then what remaining road wheels are there, and you can usually limp your way back to the command post.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the problems also was if you're going across a rice paddy, and you tried to cross a dike, and you tried to do so at an angle, you could throw a track, which means that didn't destroy the track, but you had to lay everything out and retrack it in order to get going again.
Right.
That's kind of difficult to do in 3 foot of water.
Right.
But we did it a couple of times.
Okay. Was the tank okay with traveling through the water over there?
I'm sorry?
Was the tank okay traveling through the water?
Pretty much.
There?
We didn't have any trouble. As long as it had sand in the rice paddy, we could get across it.
Okay. What other elements bothered you most as a tank platoon commander?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
What other elements? Weather, besides enemy action, what other impediments were there that hurt you as a tank commander?
Probably not too much. I'd say being a tanker, we were far better off than infantry. I mean, we could carry luxury items, so to speak, a lot of sea rations and Dr. Peppers and
right.
things like that on our tank. You know, the infantry couldn't do that.
Uh-huh.
I would say we had far fewer impediments than the average Marine. I'd say we were far better off than most of the people actually out operating in the field.
Okay. Can you tell me, sir, what you had on your person? What was your uniform like? What did you carry typically every day in the field?
Well, in the field we had, most of us at that time had the standard jungle utilities. They weren't camouflage, but they were jungle with big flaps on them and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very handy for carrying your maps and compasses and anything else that you had to have. And your little small camera that you carried with you,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. The only weapon that we carried was a 45 caliber pistol. It was in a shoulder holster arrangement. The tankers shoulder holster. Mm-hmm. And inside the tank, he had a 45 caliber, what we call a grease gun, which was sort of a little automatic weapon. And that's the only weapons that we carried personally.
Okay.
Which is why we stayed on the tanks.
Right, right. Okay, so what else would you carry personally? You had a, did you have a canteen with you? Did you have a knife?
No, I didn't. We didn't carry anything like that because mostly we, on the back of our, of the cupola of the tank was what they call a gypsy rack.
Mm-hmm.
And that gypsy rack, my platoon sergeant had gotten some, ammunition boxes and had welded some steel rods on them. And we hung, each crew member had his own separate little ammunition box with his, stuff in there,
uh-huh.
hung on the back of the gypsy rack, which, you know, we had no need to carry anything with us.
Okay.
Other than our weapons.
Okay. Did you wear a helmet most of the time when you
were... We wore a helmet. And the helmet was, its purpose of the helmet was essentially had a radio in it,
mm-hmm.
speaker, where you could basically communicate with everybody on your in your tank. And in theory, you could communicate with the infantry and aviation and other people out of that, but it really didn't work that way. The radios inside the tanks, the M48 tanks of that era, were not very good radios.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up taking the infantry radios, which were the, I think, the PRC-25s,
mm-hmm.
and we would strap those inside the tanks. That's what we used to really talk to the infantry with.
Okay. How was the coordination, the communication on the field between yourself, the infantry, and the air?
It was, I think it was very, very good. When we went out in the field, then we had our maps with us, and we... putting plastic on our map so we could basically write on. We'd write all the frequencies down of all of the units that we were operating with. There was our own unit back in the command post, the units we were operating specifically within the field, and we knew exactly how to get a hold of anybody and everybody. And the way it works in any kind of an organization, they have a radio operator and other people that are monitoring those nets, and you were almost always, I don't think I can remember any time I was not able to get a hold of a unit.
Okay. How about communication with air power?
I personally didn't have to do that often. That was mostly the infantry platoon commanders that would do that.
Okay.
If we had to do that, they had the radio operators that had the special equipment that talked to the air. And we could talk to the artillery forward observers and the artillery positions ourselves, but the aviation took a special unit.
Okay. Tell me what your impression was of the Republic of Korean Marines. You said you worked with them on your first real mission out
yes.
in the field.
Well, I'll tell you, I was very impressed with them, to be honest with you. I didn't know what to expect. You know, here
mm-hmm.
here I am going to be going down and supporting a foreign friendly organization. And I was very impressed with the fact that all the Korean officers could speak English, and most of it very, very good English.
Mm-hmm.
The Korean officers, they were very, very strong discipline. It seems to me that what they had done, they had taken the United States military organization and operating procedures and implemented them 100% the way they were supposed to be implemented.
Okay.
They were very... They were very disciplined troops. I was very impressed with them.
Okay. And this operation lasted how long, this first one?
Lasted about, I think it was about 5 or 6 days. And most of the time when we got down there, it wasn't much of an operation. We ended up mostly just patrolling in the general area to sort of screen, or like a cavalry outfit would for a old days. And we pretty much kind of screened it for them.
Okay.
Big unit, units moving through the area.
Right. Okay. And so after this operation was over, what did you do?
Well, we went back to Chulai. Mm-hmm. At that point in time, we then recognized that we were getting ready to go back to Da Nang
mm-hmm.
to rejoin my company, which was at Marble Mountain. So I had about 3 or 4 days to get the platoon ready. We took one of those days. We went out in the field and we. Got our, we bore, I guess what we call bore sighting our main guns at about 600 meters, which had not been done before. And we did that then. The reason being was that was just about the distance that we expected to meet most of our targets. And if you get your bore sighted at that distance, that made it easier for you to use Kentucky windage up or down to Kentucky windage being able to guess at where you felt a round might go. Mm-hmm. That made it a lot easier for us. So we got tried to do that to get ready for what we thought was going to be a lot more intense combat when we got to Da Nang.
Can you tell me exactly how you went about bore sighting the rifles?
Well, it was the bore sighting the main guns. Effectively, we have on the main gun, you have stereoscopic sights that you're able to use to get down to where you exactly know where you are, and you can get like a 90% chance of a first round hit if you properly do that.
Mm-hmm.
We effectively would sight in what we felt like the 600 meters were, and they would get the guns stereoscopically coordinated at that area, and then the gunner could see it inside his reticles. We knew about what 600 meters looked like, and we got the guns where they were there. They were automatically ready to fire at that distance.
You said that had not been done before you had arrived?
Well, probably should, except I think that they were looking at it before as a typical tank operation, you know, where you didn't, you know, where you expected to get targets from all distances and that sort of thing. I think that's the way they looked at it. And that was one of the things we had not done before.
Okay.
That was the first thing that the gunny and I sat down and talked about. Well, you know, we need to think about what we're getting ready to get into, because we didn't, at Chulai, it was really more of a long distance kind of an operation anyhow, whereas got up to Da Nang, it looked like it was going to be short distance. There was a lot more beelines and things like that you were going to be running into.
Right. Those tanks, those four tanks in your platoon, they were there when you had arrived. They've been in country, what, since 65, I guess?
No, I don't think they've been in. I think they've been in for maybe 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
I think they were the last of the tank battalion to deploy from Camp Pendleton.
Okay. Before we get into what happened at Marble Mountain, tell me, in the first, you know, month you're there, month and a half, and compare this with what you knew before. What was your understanding of why the United States was in Vietnam and the course of the war to that point? What was happening?
Well, at that point, like I said, I saw it because I was politically interested in things. And when I was in college, I saw we were there because we were trying to prevent the communists from taking over another third world country.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, when we fact had a they were in fact an ally. We had we were part of the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization and that
right.
sort of thing. So I saw that as our, we were simply doing our role in what we should have been doing. And I didn't see, and like I said, that was before a lot of the big political thing inside the country took place a year or so later.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw we were doing what we should have been doing, and I think all the troops that I was with saw it the same way.
Okay. And once you had gotten there, you continued thinking this way and feeling this way?
Yeah, pretty much. I saw, because I'll tell you why it was even more interesting to me, was because I had worked with the Koreans, and I had known what had happened in Korea, and I had known that a lot of people had poor opinions of the Koreans and those kinds mm-hmm. of things.
Right.
And I looked at those Korean troops, and I saw nothing but pretty outstanding Marines. They operated just the way we did, and I also knew that Korea had become a pretty economically successful country, and it appeared to me that we were trying to do the same thing in Vietnam that we'd done in Korea.
Did anything in the first few months, is there any indication to you that that would be very hard or impossible or very difficult for that to happen in South Vietnam?
Well, I think once I got to Da Nang and began to operate in the field and begin to, at Da Nang, I got a much better feel for what the war was really going to be like.
Okay.
Yeah, I could see that it was going to be very difficult, very difficult.
Okay. Can you tell me why?
Well, the reason I could see that is that, and I mean, I knew enough about what was going on politically in the country to know that we had effectively, the United States, for whatever reason, and this was at the Johnson administration, had decided not do to not fight the war, to fight it more as a political war than as a real war. In other words, we put restraints upon ourselves that we couldn't do this, we couldn't do that, and so on. And I saw us effectively being reduced to a role very similar to the one that the French
mm-hmm.
been in, where they were sitting there in a defensive posture, waiting to be hit. not going out and doing the kinds of things that you would do to make sure that you don't get hit.
Can you describe what you mean by the restraints?
Well, the restraints, for example, a couple of major operations took place during the time that I was over there that we, you know, where we would have an isolated battalion or something get hit by the North Vietnamese Army, and then we would begin to move in a large organization. We would end up in effectively almost surrounding them, but you couldn't really surround them because you couldn't go into layoffs and do the job.
Right.
And so you had them effectively with a way to disappear from Vietnam, South Vietnam, go across into Laos, and you couldn't follow them. And we left them completely alone up in North Vietnam to do whatever they wanted to do. And so we effectively had handcuffs on ourselves. We were just in a defensive posture.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How much did you know about the French War before you went over?
Well, I read Bernard Fall's book on the...
Street Without Joy?
Dien Bien Phu.
Oh, okay. Hell in a Very Small Place.
Right. Hell in a Very Small... I had not read The Street Without Joy, and I probably would have been better off had I read that one, because Street Without Joy was more like the war that I saw.
Okay.
Because it was even almost some of it was in the same general area that I was in.
Okay. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Tell me about Marble Mountain, and when you got up to Da Nang, what was your instructions for your platoon there?
Well, when we got to, it was a whole lot different tactical situation. In effect, the tank battalion or the second, the Charlie Company was in Marble Mountain, which was right across the road from the from Marine Air Group 16, which is the it was a helicopter. We were also located just to the south of the major command post of the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines.
Mm-hmm.
That's effectively who we were in support of, was the 3rd Battalion, or actually the 1st Marine Regiment. Those other, the 2nd Battalion and 1st Battalion of 1st Marine Regiment were located further south, down toward Hoi An. And my personal job, in most cases, my platoon was assigned to the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, and I spent most of my time in the general Marble Mountain area, maybe 7 or 8 miles spanned around Marble Mountain, that generally supporting 3rd Marine Regiment's operations.
Okay. What were your quarters like there at Marble Mountain?
The quarters at Marble Mountain were pretty comfortable quarters. They were, we had a, they were made out of, you know, wooden with sheet metal tops, and we had palletized sidewalks so that you'd stay out of the mud, and we had had a large building where we could get people together, and that's where I guess you'd call it the mess hall. We'd also had movies there,
right.
Order ammunition there. We had maintenance sheds, and had electricity and that sort of thing. It was pretty well appointed for somewhere out in the field.
Okay, and this is kind of your base of operations, and you go out for a period of time, then come back to this facility?
Right. We would come back to there. That's pretty much where my gunny set up and took care of all the maintenance and the fuel and all that sort of thing. And
mm-hmm.
Where I would take the troops out in the field with the on either the operations or just going out on sometimes we'd sit up at night out there with an infantry unit out in the field.
Okay.
I would say that probably maybe 5 days out of a week, I would be in the field, and maybe 2 days out of the week, I'd be in the command post.
Okay, when was this about? Do you remember when you went back over to Da Nang?
This was the time frame when I was as a platoon commander at Marble Mountain was, I would guess, October until February.
Okay.
Of 67.
Okay. All right. And, you know, after 2 months and coming to Da Nang, did you feel comfortable with the training of your men, your relationship with your men, as you were getting ready to go into more heavier combat?
Oh, yeah. By that time, I think we had molded together pretty well as a platoon and mm-hmm. as a team, and I was very comfortable with, you know, I had made several changes. I'd made sure that I had the right people as tank commanders, and the gunny was... who understood training probably better than I did for tanks, he would be the one that pretty much initiated a lot of the training. I mean, he'd get with me and we'd talk about it, but in effect, mm-hmm. he was the one that responsible for the make sure that they were trained and their specific tasks as a loader, gunner, driver, and that sort of thing.
Right. The person you replaced, what had happened to him? Do you know?
Well, I don't know what happened to him after the war at all. I know during the period of time that he was there with me, he was a... I don't think I would have been successful at all without that particular platoon sergeant. And I think most of the ones I ran into were pretty much similar people.
Okay. What happened to the lieutenant that you came in for Charlie Company? Was he promoted to captain of the company?
Well, which lieutenant are we talking about?
The Charlie Company platoon that you took over.
Oh, well, I don't know. They did not have a platoon commander when I was there.
Okay, so you don't know what happened.
No, I have no idea what... I really have never found out or even asked, I guess.
Okay.
I took over a platoon that did not have a platoon commander.
Right, and I guess at this point it doesn't really matter. But I was wondering if you had found out what had happened to him.
No, I don't. I don't. See, I'm not even sure. Yeah, I really don't know that.
Okay.
What happened.
Okay, all right. Tell me... a little bit about your initial operations there at Marble Mountain. How did you know that you were getting into more combat? Were you told basically we're going to engage the enemy here?
Well, we expected, first of all, we down at Chulai, we did not have any active Marine infantry organizations down there. They were all up in Da Nang or further north,
mm-hmm.
and so effectively, I didn't have any real infantry units to operate with at Chulai. So we knew there were Marine infantry units at Da Nang operating out in the field. So we expected that we'd be out there in the field with them.
Okay,
and which is exactly what happened when I got there. For the most part, there were probably during the period of time I was a platoon commander, I would guess there were three or four major operations, and a major operation being one where we would sit down and the battalion commander would sit down with the company commanders and with myself as the armored officer, so to speak, and we would determine what we were going to do and lay all the plans out and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then and most of the time it would be to go in and conduct what we would call a county fair or something. We had intelligence that there was Viet Cong units operating inside a particular hamlet or village or whatever,
right.
And we would go generally surround one of these places. And and it would be a combination of several things. Some of the infantry companies would be put in place with helicopters, placing them around a particular side of the village. Other infantry units would be moved in by Amtraks, amphibious tractors,
mm-hmm.
And then some of them would be riding with myself on the tank, and we would set up part of the perimeter ourselves. And if, in effect, we would surround these villages and then or hamlets. And then and do it as hermetically as possible, as quickly as possible, so that if there were Viet Cong inside the village, then they would have to disappear into their hiding holes and so on. And we would then sweep through the villages and the hamlet, and we'd set up a big area outside the hamlet with a concertina wire around it, and we would take the women, civilians, and old men, or whoever was in the villages, take them there, and we would effectively feed them. We would take a look at the kids and give them shots and give them medical treatment and things like that, and South Vietnamese authorities would send people in and talk to them and that sort of thing. And meanwhile, the Marines would be sweeping through the village looking for Viet Cong, looking for hiding places, ammunition, and we would almost always find Viet Cong in there in
mm-hmm.
their fighter holes and those kinds of things.
So you were going after the Viet Cong mainly?
Basically, in the area that I was in, we were going after pretty much the Viet Cong.
Okay.
And that was the difference in the area that I was in as compared to what was happening with my contemporaries up north,
right.
who were mostly going against the North Vietnamese Army.
Right, right.
And we went up against the North Vietnamese Army also ourselves, but it would be mostly when they would attack us. They would come across that Songkla, I forget what the river's name is, but they come across that river and they would attack one of our units.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when we mostly got involved with the North Vietnamese Army.
Okay. How would you rate the intelligence you had in the field?
Well, to be honest with you, I think it was pretty good. There were a couple of incidents occurred that I know in my written orders I talked about one incident occurred and it happened during Tet.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Marine unit was doing what I would call an administrative patrol. By that, I mean we weren't out there looking for bad guys. We were just out there trying to make sure that we didn't have large enemy units traversing the area. And one of them got attacked near a particular hamlet, and one of the Marines got killed, and I had to go out and one of my tanks pick that Marine up and bring him back. And the next that night, we sat down in the infantry command post, and the battalion commander said, look, we've got intelligence that in that particular hamlet there is, in fact, a large Viet Cong meeting taking place. And so based on the fact they'd attacked our man, that day we decided to do a little ad hoc unit where we took an infantry platoon out and my tank platoon, and I took them out, let them off, and I set up a blocking position on one end of the hamlet, and they took off and went around the north of the thing and started sweeping through the other end, and that intelligence was right on target. There must have been 100 of them in that hamlet, and had a pretty good little time there taking care of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the intelligence was pretty good, I think, considering the fact that, you know, it's pretty hard to get that kind of good intelligence. We mostly get it, I'm assuming, from Vietnamese.
Right. Can you tell me the differences in your impressions of the Viet Cong and then of the NVA?
Well, we had very little. I had some interaction with the North Vietnamese Army, but the difference simply was the Viet Cong would operate in very small groups. Mm-hmm. And their job was to ambush you, to harass you, those kinds of things, and also to intimidate the local villagers.
Mm-hmm.
The North Vietnamese Army operated as a regular infantry organization, where they were better equipped, better led, better organized, and it was more like fighting a regular organized military units.
Okay. Were the VC effective, in your opinion, at what they were trying to accomplish?
Well, I mean, I guess so. And what I didn't realize at the time, and I now realize now, is we suspected it somewhat. But to be honest with you, most of these Viet Cong were North Vietnamese Army people anyhow, mm-hmm. operating with the Viet Cong.
Okay.
And so, to be honest with you, the Viet Cong just operated differently. Because they were operating as small guerrilla units, but they really and effectively were North Vietnamese to begin anyhow.
Okay.
In other words, I think that's the thing that a lot of people didn't really understand. They tried to look at it as a civil war when effectively it was an invasion.
Right. Can you expand on that? Because that's one of the key debates about the whole war, is that what was really happening in the South? Was it a Southern insurgency? Was the Southern population up in arms, or was this really an infiltration operation?
I even came to that conclusion then, before I even knew all the information that came out about the war later on.
Really?
Because remember, the second half of my tour over there, I was a civic action officer.
Yes.
Where I got an opportunity to sit down and really get to talk to people and understand what was going on. The people that I ran into in the field and the people I ran into later on as a civic action officer, they were not unhappy at all with the South Vietnamese government.
Mm-hmm.
They were content to be left alone. There was no uprising, in my opinion, with the exception of inside the cities. Now, inside the cities, you had the Buddhists and some other people that were politically motivated and oriented. That I think was probably a civil war situation. But in the countryside, the people we operated with, I don't think they could have cared less one way or the other. There was no uprising against the government that we saw out there.
What do you think their main concerns were then?
Their main concern was for everybody to leave them alone, where they could grow their rice, they could tend their water buffaloes in their gardens and raise their children and chew their betel nut and do the things that they had done for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Right, right.
In other words, I saw them as being a very I don't want to use the word backward at all. That's not. They were very organized out in those little villages and hamlets, and they were very content.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw them as being prosperous, good people.
Okay. What would you say were the strengths and weaknesses of the Viet Cong?
Well, the strengths were their surprise. They could pick the targets and times of their choosing, so they had the ability to do that. And then, of course, because they were indigenous, at least in terms of the way they looked, were able to blend back into the countryside where you couldn't find them. So that obviously was their big strength. Mm-hmm. Their weakness was that, at least in those who were operating as guerrillas, they had to be on the move all the time, because we were out looking for them constantly, and we'd find a lot of them. And so we disrupted a lot of their activities.
When you found them, what would you do with them?
Well, we'd usually have battles with them, either kill them or capture them if we could. And I can't really say what the percentage was. I suspect we probably killed more than we captured.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying we did that deliberately. I'm saying just in the process of the battles.
Sure. Can you expand a little bit more about your contact with the Vietnamese civilians during the first half of your tour over there?
Well, the first half of the tour, my contact with the civilians were basically on operations, and then when we were actually out in the field, and it wasn't a intimate person-to-person type of interaction with them. It was effectively we were moving through their villages, and we were trying to either move them out of there into the areas so that we could protect them, so to speak, while we were sweeping through villages and so on. But many times we were on patrols where we weren't really out on an operation, but we were just going through villages or hamlets, just making sure there were no large enemy units moving around and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And there you had an opportunity to really observe them better than you did at any other time.
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, they were very peaceful-looking people. They were not particularly comfortable with us being there, but they weren't particularly uncomfortable either.
Right.
The kids would always come see you, and they wanted to talk to you.
Right.
And talk to you and play with you and so on. And we would always pass out candy to them and things like that. Because it's a typical situation where the kids are attracted to us because of our differences, I guess, and we were always attracted to them because they were kids.
Right. What did they think of the tanks, the civilians?
Well... I guess I'll give you one really good. I don't know if I could say what they were in general, how they felt, but this one particular incident was something that really has always been on my mind, probably ever since it happened, and it's still on my mind. I remember one operation that I was on when we were in a particular area and a Marine unit was being attacked. We knew where it was. We were in radio contact with them, and they needed help. And the only way I could get there was by going across a particular rice paddy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to go across the rice paddy, didn't think one way or the other about it. And all of a sudden, this family of, it was a man and his wife, and there must have been three or four little children. Well, they came out there, and I mean out of their house and so on, they were just prostrated on the ground, just begging me not to go through their rice paddy, because it looked like it was getting ready to be harvested, and this is their livelihood,
And
I had no choice, because I had a Marine unit under fire. It was in needed help, and I had to get across that rice paddy. And I'm seeing this family sitting down in front of me just begging us not to go through their rice paddy, and I had no choice. I personally got off the tank. We carried the Seladium payment cards around in our pockets that were written in Vietnamese, and I wrote on there my name. Well, my name and unit was already on there, and I wrote on there what happened so that they could take that card down and get compensated by the South Vietnamese authorities for what damages take place. That's the best thing I could do for that family. I gave it to that man and handed it to him, and I got back on my tank and we went right through that rice paddy and destroyed probably half of it going through there, but we had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never forgotten that family.
Really? I know you don't know what happened, I'm sure.
No, I had no idea whether they were compensated or whatever. I did all I could do as one, a military officer responsible for my unit and its mission, and number two, the best I could do for as a human being for another family in that situation.
Right.
And that happened a lot over there, and that wasn't just for that. Many, many other officers were put in the same position.
Right. Okay. Lieutenant Colonel Ray, why don't we stop for today?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Yeah, that.